This is the Rebellious Wellness Over 50 podcast. I'm Greg Cox, your host, and I believe it's time to bust the myth that aging equals decline or irrelevance. Nonsense. Aging happens, but it doesn't have to ruin your life. Each week, you'll hear experts who think and practice outside the box of conventional wisdom on how to age in good health so you can live fully expressed. I'm here to bust myths, help you embrace change, and live life your way. If you feel like the best of life has passed, it's time to get a little rebellious in your approach. So, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Rebellious Wellness Over 50. This seems to be the month of going behind the scenes of Western medicine with experts who have great information for us. Today, my guest is Susan Salinger, like JD you have on your website. Welcome, Susan. Susan is an author of a book called Sidelined, How Women Can Navigate a Broken Healthcare System. And I know many of the people listening here would agree that it is broken. You have also had a film company with your husband. Are you still distributing films?
No, we sold that about 10 years ago. No, my gosh, 20 years ago at this point.
You lost a decade. We all do that, right?
It's true.
So what we're going to talk about today is the barriers that women face in getting the best medical care. And I think that this might be a subject that a lot of women, they may inherently feel dismissed or, but I didn't know until I started reading your work that we really do get less good healthcare, less good diagnosis. So take it away. Where do you want to start?
Oh my goodness. Well, I think first of all, I want to say that we really do get less effective healthcare. I knew that it wasn't quite as good as men's, but frankly, not only from researching this book, but I've begun my second book, and I was appalled to find out that if women have a heart attack, for example, and go to emergency, we wait 11 minutes longer to get attended to than men do. We get less electrocardiogram, you know, EKGs. It's just appalling because the damage to the heart muscle can be so significant. Time is not your friend when you have a heart attack. That was one example of our less effective care. There's many more. I mean, that so many times doctors don't believe our reports of pain and they tell us, you know, oh, it's all in your head. Here are some antidepressants. And when those don't work, then they say, well, it's really in your head. Here are some more antidepressants, you know. So I was appalled at all of that. And I think part of the reason, because I am a firm supporter of Western medicine, I believe it strongly, and I mean, I know you do too. But one of the things that did surprise me is that women researchers get much less money to do their research than men researchers. And if a researcher is researching a woman's disease, they get less money. And women researchers get published less often than male researchers. So really, if you're a woman researcher, this is hard to say, researching a woman's disease, you're going to find yourself at the bottom of the publication barrel. So I think that one of the reasons that our care is less effective is that doctors know less about our bodies. I mean, it's that simple.
Yeah, and so many things, procedures, medical devices, medications are tested on men generally. Right. I mean, I guess it's better now. I'm hoping it's better now. But
it's better now, but it's still mostly 6-foot, you know, white men, cisgender men. Mm-hmm. Marginalized populations are not tested, but women are still not tested as often as men. And frequently, even when they participate in the trials, the research isn't necessarily segregated by sexes. So it's lumped into one result, and there's probably more than one result. I mean, Ambien affects women differently from men. I mean, that's a good example. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem.
The woman I interviewed last week talked about the Wegovy class of drugs. Semaglutide, I guess, is the drug with all these different that people are taking off-label. It was designed for diabetes. She said that the only trials they did were on white men. Mm-hmm. And Japanese men, for some reason, they did a cohort in Japan. Japan did its own cohort. And for 6 months, that was the design. And first of all, many of these drugs will be wanted by women of color who generally have more weight issues after menopause, that kind of thing.
Right.
And yet there's no result that came from women because there were no women used.
Yeah, you know, I have to just say, I hate to proselytize, but I am so anti any kind of medication unless you really need it.
Yeah.
I think there are so many medications where the cure can truly be worse than disease. And frankly, that's easy for me to say because I've always been fairly healthy. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I think twice before I even take an aspirin for a headache because it's a blood thinner. And yeah. I'm older and I get scared, you know. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I don't take a vitamin. I really don't. I have a very good diet. I don't take calcium, even though I have osteoporosis, but I eat plenty of yogurt and cottage cheese. So I try to do it that way. And I never quite know if I'm healthy because I don't take meds or maybe I was just lucky. I mean, I probably was, of course.
Yeah.
But I think that taking any kind of supplements or medications that have not been clinically tested, that have not been around for a long time, without your doctor's advice, I think you're playing with fire.
Yeah, that was Sue's, the woman's name was Sue Robati. Her message also was never take a new drug. She said, if you need a medication and your doctor says, this one just hit the market, say, can I have an old one? Even if it's not quite as fast and effective. Right. It will be effective enough and I'll be fine with it.
Well, you know, honestly, that's why I wrote the drug. It's why I wrote the book, because I'm, you know, about 40 or 50 years ago, I mean, because I'm so old at this point, but I had some exploratory surgery that I knew I didn't need. I had been on a drug for hormone, for whatever it was, for osteoporosis, even at that age. And the doctor said, and I was doing fine. And the doctor said, hey, I've got this new drug. Let's try it. It's supposed to be better for osteoporosis. Well, I was a kid. What did I know? So I said, sure. What the heck? You know, and I tried it and I started some vaginal bleeding. And I said, listen, I got to go back to the old drug. It's obviously this drug. And he said, no. I've never had anybody have this symptom. And even then I kind of said to myself, of course you haven't, because it's brand new. But I didn't, because as I was a kid. Anyway, to make a long story short, I had exploratory surgery. I was just fine, went back on the old drug, and you know, everything stopped. It was just drug. So that's kind of a enhancing your story about don't take new drugs, because they don't know, you know.
And it's also kind of this what you said earlier about it's all in your head.
Yeah,
clearly, because that symptom had never turned up in his practice before.
Right.
It must have been you and not the symptom being real.
Right, right, yeah. Right, exactly. And he was actually looking for ovarian cancer at that point, because vaginal bleeding is a sign.
Yeah.
And you know, let's face it, if he'd been right, he would have saved my life.
Exactly.
But he wasn't, you know. Yeah. I could have waited a week or two, gone back on the old pill and seen what happened. I mean, I wasn't going to keel over, at least at that moment.
Right, right. So why... There are, we all have, probably all have friends with stories about, you know, a surgery that turned out to be unnecessary,
right,
or a diagnosis that resulted in a medication that made them vaginal bleeding or depression, you know,
right.
And it seems like there's a medication for everything. You talked about antidepressants. I know they give antidepressants now for perimenopause and menopause.
Right.
When in fact, that really, that hormone fluctuation, now for some women that end up with clinical depression, I'm not talking about you. Women, go get yourself
right.
What you need, the help you need.
Right, exactly.
But cyclical feelings of being low and unhappy and moody is really part of the hormone dance that happens as we're coming to the end
right.
of the hormone.
Absolutely. But, and I think it's particularly interesting because, as I mentioned, women wait longer to get treatment for a heart attack. And they are, I can't remember the percentage, but a great deal more frequently, they are prescribed antidepressants instead of getting an EKG, which would validate a heart attack if that indeed was what they're having. I mean, it could be depression. I don't mean that it couldn't.
Right.
But nevertheless, the first thing women are given is antidepressants of some sort.
Wow. That's really scary.
That ain't going to do you much good.
No. And I also think somebody could do a better job, perhaps me. I'm looking for the right person to interview about the differences between a woman's symptoms of a heart attack and a man's. Because we all see on TV the guy or the woman
right.
clutches their chest,
right.
they fall to the floor. Call 911. That's not necessarily the case for women.
In fact, I know a little bit about that because my second book is going to be on gaslighting and misdiagnoses and all those things. And heart attacks are such good examples. Men have quite different symptoms than we do. And the problem with our symptoms is twofold. one, the major problem is women, well, so can men, but a lot of women can have silent heart attacks, in which case there's no symptoms at all. So how the hell are you supposed to know? Mm. But the other thing is that we don't necessarily have chest pain. Women can have high anxiety. So can men. When I say women, I meant some men too. I'm only talking about what's predominant in women. Mm-hmm. We can have jaw pain, high anxiety, fatigue, really low energy, which is kind of different from fatigue, loss of appetite. And unfortunately, the problem is, of course, those symptoms fit maybe thousands of times. So it's really hard to leap and say, oh my God, I'm having a heart attack. And I think that the trick is, and I really want to emphasize this, time again, as I said earlier, it's of the essence. If you have any idea that you're having a heart attack, call the paramedics immediately, because you could do real damage to your heart muscle if you screw around with it. Mm-hmm. So our symptoms, let me see if I can remember them so that you really know. There's anxiety, there's fatigue, there's depression, there's sweating, trouble breathing. It differs from a panic attack, because a panic attack will go away in a few minutes, where the anxiety from a heart attack is more likely to stay with you for a while. Mm. I mean, that's one clue. I'm trying to think what else. Pain in your arm.
I've heard of indigestion, that some women feel indigestion.
In fact, that's another thing I want to say. I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of times for those women who go to emergency and are not given an antidepressant, they're frequently told they have a stomach ache. And the secret to both of those problems is really request, and if you need to, insist on an EKG. It's the only way to quickly tell if you're having a heart attack. There's blood tests and things, but they take longer to get the results. Mm-hmm. I think that's most of it. It's the silent heart attack that's particularly tricky. Mm. I mean, how in the heck do you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you do have, I'm thinking of how you just said when you get to the hospital and you think you're having, insist on an EKG. What other things that have you discovered can help my listeners navigate the healthcare system? Let's start with the doctor's office and then we'll go to the hospital.
Fair enough. First of all, I have some really good ideas, I think anyway, when you visit the doctor. The first thing you want to do is write down a list of your symptoms. And notice I said write down, because that's very important. Having them in your head, if you're at all like me, I get so anxious that I can't mm-hmm. even remember why I'm there. And I'm so busy trying to be a good patient and trying to be a friend that I forget that I'm really sick. And that's why I came in the first place. But if you write down your list and you prioritize it, that is really helpful. It keeps you on track. It puts the whole visit on track. It focuses things. And just as a sidebar, I had a doctor, I was on a podcast with a doctor about a month or two ago, and she was saying she loves it when patients come in with a list. And she told me the story about a man that came in and he, you know, they went through everything more or less. He didn't have a list, but he listed his symptoms, you know, orally or verbally. And then as he was, just as she was ready to leave, he said, well, you know, I do have this mole on my back, which of course was the most important thing he'd said the whole visit. So she turned around, you know, but she said if he'd had a written list, she would have seen that and started with it rather than end. So doctors appreciate a list as well, is my point.
Yeah.
The second thing I'm going to say is I think it's really important to do your research. So if the doctor says you have disease X, you want to ask them to write it down and spell it for you, because some of these diseases are tricky to spell. And go home or wherever you have access to a computer and look it up. Don't go to Dr. Google, because some of those sites are particularly wrong.
One-sided. Let's say one-sided.
Thank you. That's better. And some of them are full of nonsense. I mean, honestly, there's a resource list at the back of my book where I have categorized. I mean, it tells you where to look up your symptoms. I gave all the reliable websites that I used when I researched the book. It tells you how to research your doctor, how to research your hospital. Some hospitals specialize in cardiology, others neurology. It tells you how to research your symptoms. All kinds of things. I've done the research for you. All you have to do really is go to the back of the book and go to the website that it tells you to go to. So the second thing you're going to do is research your symptoms. You've got your list, you got your diagnosis, and I really should have said this in a different order, but you've researched your symptoms. The other thing that I think is really important is to tell your doctor in your own words what you heard them say. And that does two things. It gives the doctor a chance to be sure that they said what they really meant to say. I mean, we all misspeak.
Yeah.
And it gives you a chance to be sure that you really heard what you were meant to hear and that you heard correctly. And the reason I'm saying that is there was an appalling statistic that only 15% of women will tell the doctor when they don't understand something.
Wow.
That means that 85% of us leave the doctor's office without fully understanding what we've been told.
Mm.
So I think that that's really important. And then the last thing, if you can, is just take somebody with you, because four ears are definitely better than two.
Absolutely.
And, you know, a question I always ask when I do get a diagnosis is, what else could this possibly be?
Mm.
Because now I have two things to look up, and I want to know where the doctor's mind is going. I mean, it's just nice to have a second option. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think if I can add to your do the research, on the medications that they want to give you, unless you're in a critical moment of, I need this medication to live and get to my car, or then you can say, okay, let me go home and research that. I just like to do a little research on this medication you've given me, you know, and then I'll call your office or go to my portal and you can call my pharmacy if it's a go. If not, maybe we can discuss another option, because I find that, again, when they, you know, we may not understand what they're saying. The diagnosis has a long name. Sometimes the drugs, semaglutamide, you know, all these things. And we go, oh, okay, that's a statin, or that's a blood pressure med. But do we really know? There are so many statins. There are like 10 or 12 different varieties.
Absolutely.
And not everyone will be good for everyone. Blood pressure medications, all kinds of variety. So again, I'm just throwing that out because I think it's important for people to know what the contraindications are for their age group.
Well, let me tell you what happened to me. I mean, almost happened to me because I did do my research, but I'm one of the lucky people. I've never had any pain. So one morning I woke up and my thumb really hurt and I just didn't think anything of it. But, you know, about 3 weeks later, the stupid thing was still hurting. So because of all this research, and this happens to anybody that does medical research, I figured I had bone cancer or some terrible disease. I mean, of course. So I went to the doctor and she said, no, you have arthritis of the thumb. No worries. And she said, here's something that will help you with the pain. I mean, it really wasn't that severe, but she said, here's a pill. And I said, well, you know, I'm on Lexapro for depression. I recently lost my husband, so I can't go without the Lexapro, at least right now. Will the pain medication interfere with the Lexapro? And she said, no, not at all. No problem. So I trotted out of her office, came home and looked it up. And she was mostly right, mostly being the key word, because there was a 1% chance that the combination of the two could give you a brain bleed. Now, I'm talking about a sore thumb with maybe, you know, a brain. Are they kidding me? So I thought, there's no way in hell I'm taking this medication.
Oh, my goodness.
So my thumbs are fine, you know.
Sorry to hear about your husband.
Thank you very much.
I can commiserate with you on the thumb, because about three weeks ago, I woke up with this incredibly painful knob on my first thumb joint. And I looked it up. I think I had one before. And it's called a ganglion cyst.
Yeah.
Arthritis in the hand produces these cysts occasionally because the bone on bone. It's this whole story. But when it first happened, I thought, if I don't see a doctor now, I'm going to cut my own thumb off. It hurts so bad. Then by the time the appointment came 2 weeks later, I was like, eh. He said, do you want any medication? I said, no. He said, do you want me to drain it? I was like, not on your life. It's fine for now. Point being, I didn't need the medication, so I didn't take it. You were in a different situation. But what happens one day we wake up and our thumbs hurt? It's bizarre.
Why 6 or 5 or 6 weeks later, did it just go away? Arthritis is not supposed to do that, is it?
I'm glad that whatever our thumbs are doing, I'm glad they're doing it.
Susan. But, you know, a brain bleed, really? I
mean, and somebody might minimize 1%. 1%. What's the chance that you'll be that 1%? Well, what if you are?
What if you are? You
gave up your brain for a thumb?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like you said earlier, sometimes you have no choice, in which case, oh, well.
It's like those medications on television where the guy at the end or the woman at the end, and it's like, and you may experience death. I was listening to one the other day. I'm like, really? I might experience death, but my skin will be clear?
You're going to look so good
I'll
in your
look
cabin.
So good. Exactly.
It's true. It's really true.
Oh, my goodness.
I want to talk about choice for a moment.
Yes, like please.
In every podcast, I try to get this in, that how important I think second opinions are. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you why. There's about roughly 30 to 40,000 different diseases out there. And those are just the ones we know about, COVID being one of the ones we didn't know about, for example. And many of those diseases have similar symptoms. So if you go into your doctor, like we said earlier, we say, I'm tired, I got no energy, I have no appetite. I mean, there's 30 to 40,000 diseases that doctor can pick from. It's really being a detective. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's important to know when you go into the doctor, perceptual bias comes into play a lot when a doctor does a diagnosis. For example, the same symptoms will look like stomach problems to a gastroenterologist. They'll look like stress to a psychologist. So if you're told that it's just arthritis in the thumb, I wouldn't worry about it, particularly unless it continued. But if you're told you need chemotherapy or that you have whatever, something really serious with a very serious prognosis and a very serious medication that's being prescribed, I really think it's so important to get a second opinion. And when you get that second opinion, you want it from somebody different from your first doctor. In other words, your point is to get a different perspective. Don't go to somebody in the same office. Because I'm on the West Coast, I always say if your first doctor's from UCLA, go to somebody who trained at NYU or Johns Hopkins or whatever. You want a totally different perspective. And if you're lucky, or unlucky, depending, the diagnosis will be confirmed. And if it isn't, if your insurance will pay for it, you may need a third opinion.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's that insurance wall for some people.
Right, of course.
Unfortunately.
And you have to have the resources to have that many doctors, you know. I mean, if you live in a more rural community, I'm near San Francisco, I have a choice of a ton of doctors. Mm-hmm. But that certainly isn't true for everybody. And I was from... I had even more down there. I mean, you know, there was millions of doctors.
Yeah. Kind of like being in Florida.
Yeah, right.
Millions
exactly.
And millions of doctors. Yeah. You trip over them walking down the street.
It's true.
So what about, now that we're talking about second opinions and hospitals, different hospitals, what if you have to navigate the hospital system? You get a diagnosis, let's say you have some kind of cancer. What can you tell us about navigating? What should we know going into these situations that are going to be stressful to begin with? Do you have any advice for people that might have to be going to get surgery,
I have very little, because in all honesty, I did not research that. I can only tell you that what I'm saying is what I would do. First of all, I would have been sure before I went into the hospital, because they can be just hotbeds of infection, as you know. I would have had a second, and because I do have the resources here, probably a third opinion, unless the two opinions agreed. So that would be, and I would have done my research. Secondly, I would have, let's say, met the surgeon or the radiologist or the whomever, so I could evaluate what I thought of them, because I'm pretty intuitive. And if somebody's a jerk, I'm truly not interested. And every profession has its share of jerks. I mean, some are just not empathic. Some are less competent than others, et cetera. And I would also insist that if it's a teaching hospital, because I'm near University of San Francisco, UCSF, that's a teaching hospital, I want to make sure that a senior doctor is there. I don't want an intern or a resident. I want somebody with plenty of experience. And again, I would research to be sure that I'm assuming it's surgery, let's just say for a minute, or oncology. You want to make sure they've treated a number of cases. You don't want to be the first chemotherapy case in the hospital. I mean, that seems obvious. But, you know, it's really interesting. There was just a statistic that people research a new car or a new job for 8 or 10 hours. They research their doctor or their surgeon for like 0 hours.
Wow.
And wow is right. Because you really can end up, you know, there was this is terrible because it was, you know, 80 years ago or 60 years ago. But at UCLA, they took out the wrong kidney of somebody.
Wow. That's another wow.
Dialysis for the rest of his life. I mean, the malpractice suit must have been fantastic.
Ooh, it's a hell of a way to come into money, Susan.
Right, exactly. So that's why I'm saying you really want to be sure. I mean, mistakes can happen. Listen, stuff happens. But you really want to be sure that the doctor that you, or surgeon, or what, as I said, oncologist that you're going to, has been in the business a while. Mm-hmm. I don't want a fresh face necessarily. And I think, I guess I would probably get a patient advocator, although I would certainly take somebody for me. I mean, both my daughters are sort of medically oriented. So I would make sure that they were with me because, again, I get so anxious that I can't
I think we all do. And we forget to ask what we want to ask. And we hear selectively because we're worried about what he or she is going to say.
Well, and if somebody told me I had cancer, I'd go south. I wouldn't hear another word and do on that, really, on that question.
Mm-hmm. No, that was great, helpful.
It's so interesting to me, though, that the title of, as we started to talk, you know, before the podcast, but the title of your podcast is so interesting to me because, I mean, I certainly don't love aging. I mean, I'm 81. I don't love being 81. I don't know how I got here. I can't figure out where
That's what my 91-year-old aunt keeps saying. So
yeah,
beware. It's not going to change.
No, it's not. But, you know, I made it. I mean, yep. I'm doing everything I can with my life, A, to stay healthy, but B, I'm living every second of it. Mm-hmm. I'm not fading into the woodwork and lying on the couch. I mean, I do a ton of exercise and I'm starting a second book. Now, I admit I've made my children promise that they promise to finish it posthumously if that's what it takes, because I am older. I mean, I'm not a fool, but still I'm starting it. I'm engaged.
Which is critical. The engagement piece, the connection piece is critical to our well-being as we age.
It is. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I have heard, it probably is in your book, and I didn't get to read it before we talked, that women of color get different and possibly less care, less caring care than the white population. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I can. And I mean, it's absolutely accurate. Again, for the second book, I've been researching heart attacks. And I think I know I mentioned that white women wait, you know, 11 minutes longer than white men. Women of color wait 15 or 20 minutes longer. Mm. They get less EKGs, even though they're more prone to diabetes. They get less insulin shots, less pre-diabetes care. Their care is not nearly as good as Caucasian women. Mm. And again, there's less research. What happens is the research that is done on, or some of the research that is done on women of color just gets lumped into the pool of women. It doesn't necessarily, they don't get singled out, which they need to be, because there are some differences.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they get less nutrition counseling, for example. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Yeah. And I would imagine it might be harder. I'm not going to say the race matters in terms of whether we stand up for ourselves. I'm talking about the culture around which a person grows up, where they grow up in culturally, environmentally, all those socially, those aspects for many women, especially in low-income households who are also of color, may not have been brought up into the idea that they can stand up for themselves, speak up and ask questions.
Yeah, you're so right. And that's really the moral of my book is you've only got one body. Take care of it. Stand up for it. It's your body. I mean, after I had that surgery, I could not believe that I had agreed to it. I couldn't believe myself. I mean, I'm not a stupid woman. Why did I do that? I got scared, obviously.
Yeah. But I mean, you were young, like you said.
Yeah. I would never do that today. Not in a million years. I would do everything we talked about, you know, research everything. It's my body and I don't want to get a brain bleed. I'd rather have a sore thumb. And I mean, that's a personal decision, but there it is.
You know? Exactly. And that is, you mentioned choice before. I would say that not always, because life or death is a different kind of choice than what we're talking about, a brain bleed or a thumb.
Right.
But pretty much we have a choice to whom we allow to do things to our body, to help us or care for us or surgerize our, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. So I would say to the people listening, if you have people in your life that aren't good at speaking up for themselves, go with them if you can.
Yes.
You know, go to the doctor, go to the office of the psychiatrist, whatever it is. And I go with my husband. My husband goes with me. And we always have a conversation before, what is the most important thing you want to leave the office with? Because again, we forget in the middle of the conversation with the doctor, they've got their white coat, the thing is around their neck. We make sure we each listen. And at the end of the conversation, it's like, oh, don't forget, you wanted to bring this up.
Right. And that's why I suggest writing it out. It helps.
Yeah, especially if you're going alone. So what else do we have for the women listening?
Well, let's see. Could we just talk about old age again for a second?
Sure. I love talking about old age.
It really bothered me when you were saying earlier, and I mean, I know you're right, that some people just sort of give up. Oh, well, I'm old. I can't do this. I can't do that. And I just want to say nonsense. And I mean, even if you're ill, there's always things you can do. I would most of the time, not always, I shouldn't say always. But I think that it's just so important, as you said, and I said too, to keep engaged. And the best thing, Jane Fonda said this, I'm going to quote Jane Fonda, which I never thought I would, but smart lady. She said, the best thing you can do for old age is prepare for it. Mm. And I think that's so true. And by that, she meant eat healthy, take care of yourself, go to the doctor, stay in charge, get plenty of exercise, walk or do whatever you do. And I just think it's so important to live life as I find. Well, I mean, unfortunately, my husband died. I mean, that certainly put a damper on things. But otherwise, it was really my 70s. He died when we were 78. So I'm 81. So the last 3 years have sucked. But before that, it was a lovely time in life. Our kids were out of the house. It was just the two of us. We live in the wine country, which is beautiful. He was an artist. He was doing his art. I was writing the book. It was just a lovely, peaceful time. We both got exercise and went and traveled a little bit. I mean, it was lovely. Mm-hmm. As my father used to say, the best thing about old age is we finally stopped worrying about dying young. And that was really true.
I've never heard that before. I love it.
It's a good point, isn't it?
It certainly is a good point.
Every age, you know, or I should say every stage, I think, has its positives and its negatives.
Yeah, of course. And I don't want anybody listening to feel like we're making light of the things that do change.
Right.
I'll say for the worse.
My energy's not quite what it was.
Yeah.
I admit that, you know.
And I'm not as strong. I do a lot of gardening. I, you know, used to be able to heft those 40-pound sacks of soil. Right. Now I ask, can you guys buy the 15-pound sacks? Because, and I used to be so bothered by that. But now I'm just thinking, at least I still garden, which I love to do.
Yes.
At least I can do, and I can be outside and listen to the bees. It's just finding anything that you enjoy,
right.
Make sure that you have time for that in your life.
I do a lot of Pilates. I do weightlifting. I do both. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to walk. I get so bored, but I'm trying.
See, I would rather walk. Pilates bores me. That's the funny thing.
No, Pilates doesn't. The weightlifting bores me. Well, they both bore me. I mean, I hate exercise, but I do.
Yeah, I
hate
it, actually. And now that we're having this conversation, I guess I can't let myself off today because I was feeling really not like exercising today. But I guess when I get off the phone, I will do something.
I know. It's so hard.
Well, but there's other things to do, you know? There's a
Always.
Project over here and a project over there. And
That's true about writing too, because it has to be entirely self-motivated.
Yeah.
And I can always, I mean, and I love to write, but I can think of, 42 things I'd rather do. Just, I'll write later, I promise.
Yeah, I wrote a book, I don't know, it was 8-9 years ago on perimenopause, pretty much, the myths about aging and health.
Yes.
And I was lucky enough that I was able to borrow somebody's, their pool cottage, like the little cottage by their pool, which is completely not winterized, shut down, and nobody was around because they don't stay at this house. So I would go there. I had electricity, of course, and a little space heater, but there was no television, no radio. I had my computer. If I wanted to goof off, I guess I could, but I would just go there with my tea kettle and my cup 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours at a time. And that was how I got it done. Because when I was home upstairs in my office, I'd close the door and then I'd be thinking, is it time to make dinner yet? Did I have tea? Should I go downstairs?
Exactly.
What was that noise? So anyway, but it really is a self-motivated thing, but I had to isolate or I got too distracted.
That's beginning to be that's what's happening. I've got podcasts to do and walks to take and I have to go to the market and
right. Oh, and then I have to eat.
Of course.
And your website, I want to make sure people know where to find you. It's Susan Salinger, SalenGer.com. There are links to any bookseller you might want, including Indigo Books for Canada, to buy her book.
This Navigate a Broken Healthcare System.
Well, Susan, I have loved this conversation and I really appreciate all of your expertise sharing it with us here at Rebellious Wellness. And one thing I meant to say before is the Rebellious Wellness idea is really about standing up for how you want to do your health and healthcare and aging. And that's the rebellious piece, because in some worlds, in ours, in many cases, it is rebellious to I'm not going to say talk back to a doctor, but have your feelings heard, have your voice in the room with the doctor is an act of rebellion sometimes.
Right.
But I encourage women and men to be okay with that. They're just human beings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And if the doctor's not okay with it, change doctors.
All right, people, thank you for listening. I will be back with another guest next week. And in the meantime, if you like this episode or any of the episodes you hear, I wish you would share them with your friends. Thanks so much, Susan, again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. I hope you've enjoyed that episode, and I thank you for listening. I'd love to connect with you on social media if you happen to play over there on Instagram and Facebook. I'm at RebelWell50. LinkedIn, of course, is my name. And on TikTok, just look for the Rebellious Wellness Over 50 page. And I look forward to connecting. You know, this is a big year of connection for us. This is how we get through tough times, is being in community with like-minded people. And if you're a listener, I believe we are.